Hello. Ladies and gentlemen, the director of The Lady Killers. It is at a moment like this, when you're standing in front of the audience at the world premiere of your new movie, and you think to yourself, I wish I had prepared something to say. I would like to ask all of you to turn off your mobile devices to make sure they make no noise, and especially so that they don't illuminate. We storytellers at our best know that when the prevailing cultural conversations are not nourishing, it is incumbent upon us to start our own. And I would very much like to thank my new friend Gustavo and North Hollywood Cinefest for carving out a space where so many amazing conversations have been taking place this weekend.
Thank you.
I would like to thank all of you for supporting independent film in a variety of ways. I know that half of you are really going to enjoy this movie tonight. And certainly all of you are courageous for having paid for the opportunity to be made uncomfortable and angry. Responses that I assure you are absolutely understandable given some of the behavior you are going to witness in this film. As both a filmmaker and as a California State Certified Violence Prevention Specialist, I had grown increasingly disturbed by what I saw as a proliferation of exploitative imagery being produced, marketed, and consumed as entertainment and diversion. So, at the urging of my good friend Bert Bulos, I decided to make a dark comedy that depicted some of the ramifications of exploitation in its many forms. Love the movie or hate it, actually, especially so if you hate it. Please stick around afterwards. Several special guests will join me and we'll discuss these issues and so much more, but I will try to answer one question right now that occurred to me at a preview screening we had not very long ago, which was, why make a movie that is so unsettling that even I'm uncomfortable watching it? Let alone what all of your reaction is going to be. And it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who probably answered that question best when he wrote that only so far as people are unsettled is there any hope for them.
From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood
Hour.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
So much to get to, Dean Haglund, and we're 24 hours late in doing so. How are you, sir?
Are we 24 hours late, or are we 92 hours? I don't even know the joke to that. Yes, I'm doing very well, thank you.
Well, interesting. You know, I mean, we had the world premiere of The Lady Killers on Sunday night.
Yes.
And
how did that go?
It went terrific. I mean, it was everything I could have hoped for beyond somebody dropping a gigantic check in our lap. But I would never even hope for that. But the interesting thing coming out of a conversation with a distributor today was this concept. They liked that, I pointed out the historical uniqueness of the genre that is dark comedy, about how one lands roughly every 12 years, every 10 to 15 years, one really moves the needle conversationally, right, and really catches the imagination. The last one being Neil LaBute's In the Company of Men. And
right,
not coincidentally, a review came down during the night calling our film Neil LaBute's In the Company of Men only darker and with more laughs, which is kind of the coolest review I could imagine. This reminds me of the old days when I used to read our reviews on the show. But but the interesting thing, and I thought that this was something you'd really kind of dig, was this mm-hmm. this distributor had enough historic knowledge of film to talk about another kind of genre and how one every decade would work, but never more than one. And so we got into this really interesting discussion about how, going back to Karl Rove, I Love You, and then certainly with The Truth Is Out There, and now with The Lady Killers, I set out to make these movies where when I get the impetus to make them, it's clear that I'm a few years ahead of the cultural conversation that's ready to take place, which is how it has to be, because it takes so gosh darn long not only to make a movie, but if you're making something unique like the movies I just described, to really perfect the tone of it, right? The challenge of
Absolutely.
Making Truth Is Out There was an enormous undertaking, and so it would take time. But if I had taken even longer and we released this, The Truth Is Out There, this year, can you imagine how much interest there would be in it? For all the reasons that we talked about a couple weeks ago on the show. I don't mean to be patting myself on the back so much as saying that it's something to look at in my process that, okay, stop thinking I've got to go faster than I am. If anything, take the time I need to get the tone right, to get the film right, and then look at, okay, what's the cultural wave? And try to catch that, because timing is everything in terms of distribution, not just
Absolutely.
In terms of storytelling.
Right, because all films live in context of each other. And as society changes, as large events, as you say, push the cultural needle one way or the other, so too then all the films. I mean, think about 9/11, how Schwarzenegger's action film had to be pulled from cinemas. And my writer's friends had this weird, quirky script. I think it was called A Town Called Banana. And the day after 9/11, everybody freaked out, and everybody called wanting to read that script. They wanted something surreal and light, but not rooted. Like, everybody so disassociated themselves from the reality of that moment that it took quite a while for everyone to get back on their feet and producing a slate of films again.
And whereas, of course, everything has become so corporate, starting really with, we've talked about this before, but really beginning in the late 70s with the franchise tentpole model, you see at the same time really the integration of corporations at the top of all these media companies. And so mm-hmm. it became about a bigger model, even though, as we've discussed, the irony being that the financial margins, even though all these numbers seem so much bigger, the financial margins for all these companies have never changed. It's just, it used to be a lot of films with smaller budgets and smaller box office revenue, and now it's fewer films with larger budgets and larger box office revenue, but the profit margin is no different, ironically. But
ironically, yeah.
But the companies are all now about two things that ignore timing. One is, well, we've got to stake our flag in the sand, right? We're getting 4,000 theaters on this date. So now we have to hit that date, regardless of whether that date is right for the story that you're telling. And then the other thing that they're doing is always when something does hit big, and this distributor was involved with your friend Nia Vardalos's My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And said, you know, every filmmaker after that for quite a while would reference that, you know, would make that film their reference point. Like, it's going to be the next one. They would always take the outlier that was this huge example and say, we're going to recreate that success. And both independent filmmakers, but also corporations do this all the time. Jackie Chan appears in Rush Hour, and suddenly every studio in town, the executives are walking in on Monday morning after seeing the grosses for the first Rush Hour saying, why aren't we in the Jackie Chan business? And you know why we're not? Because we're not Hong Kong filmmakers. Those were the people in the Jackie Chan. And it was until someone really showed how you could do it that it worked here. But that didn't mean just going and grabbing every script and putting Jackie Chan in. It was going to now work. And so it's about, and this goes all the way back through, going back to Star Wars. Star Wars almost bankrupted Hollywood, right? It almost bankrupted Hollywood.
Right.
Why? Because this movie that no one actually wanted, even Fox, proved that there was this huge audience appetite for space adventure. So now every studio was trying to recapture that, and they almost drove themselves into bankruptcy trying. Krull? Anyone? Space Hunter? Anyone? Anyone?
Black Hole? Disney? That was Disney. They almost collapsed under the black hole.
And the irony was that they hadn't learned their lesson from 10 years earlier with 2001 A Space Odyssey, where they would try to capture that audience with a whole lot of with Soylent Green and Silent Running and so many other movies. And it wasn't until Star Wars that a movie proved, yes, there actually is an audience for this kind of movie. But...
Right.
Not for every one of this iteration, especially if what you're doing is try to recreate this other movie. No, both those movies had one thing in common other than space, which is the filmmakers both took an individual approach to the underlying mythologies involved and totally different expressions of those mythologies, however. So the idea would have been, no, don't go after Star Wars. Go find someone who has an interesting take on the underlying universal mythology. And if you find a storyteller
right.
with an unique individual take, then give them the opportunity. But shouldn't that be your job all the time?
Absolutely. Damsel in distress. I mean, this is this goes back to screenwriters and how it seems nobody reads a screenplay anymore. It's sort of all you get is the elevator pitch. Maybe the first two acts, if you're lucky, and then you write a check from there. And so, that's the malaise that's going on and only getting worse now that we have product locomotives and, multi-level stack marketing that extends out 10, 25 years into the future with multiple sequels and, you know, like Kong the Skull Island. That is now going to be... the monster universe that there's Godzilla references and hidden Easter eggs all through that Kong movie. So there's going to be multiple Godzilla movies coming out in that same universe, you know, and Mothra and the three-headed dragon, whatever that one was called. So all of that is going to be coming out in the next 10 to 25 years. And whether or not we are in a sociological part where we even want to see radioactive monsters arising from the ocean.
Well, I it was interesting because I spent so much time at the film festival this weekend, and I love doing that and seeing these films that are being made by other independent filmmakers, and I want to talk about some of those, but it was a really interesting weekend because along with the handful of indie movies I saw, including our own, I saw Kong, Skull Island, and Beauty and the Beast. And could there be two more... obvious product locomotives than, right. than these two. And Kong Skull Island as a movie, I actually kind of got a kick out of.
Really?
You know, it really
good.
Did capture a fun kind of B-monster movie aesthetic that I thought Peter Jackson's Kong did not. And though what is sad is like the first half hour, they take the time to really set up a fun... ensemble cast B-movie aesthetic like the first Independence Day. And and yet somehow it's actually both probably but either way you could have fixed this, but you've got very good actors and in some cases great actors giving really inauthentic performances. And part of it is because I don't think they're given time. They're on their own to find something real to root it in, and they clearly weren't given time. So we're talking about Oscar winner Brie Larson. We're talking about Tom Hiddleston. We're talking about John Goodman, Samuel L. Jackson. These are real actors. Shea Whigham comes off pretty well, and I think he should, because he's the kind of actor who's not a star and he's making a career largely on doing more with less. So he's used to not having the time, especially as a lot of, television actors have to do, right? So,
yeah, yeah.
So I feel like a lot of these actors weren't given time and therefore were cast adrift a little bit, and it doesn't serve them and their skill set. So what the original Independence Day did so well was it kind of cast B-movie actors instead right. of A-list actors in a B-movie. If you're going to do that, A-list actors in a B-movie, you got to give them a chance to create something and find it and then really embody it. So that's my problem with the first half hour of the movie. But once they get to Skull Island, John C. Reilly gets introduced. And he is so responsible for this film working. He created a guy and brought it with him. He played a character. And John C. Reilly is so adept at straddling a line between character performance and caricature comment.
Yeah,
he's so good, and doesn't that kind of I don't know, that's a great way of encapsulating this modern retro B movie aesthetic, is that combination.
And that's fascinating, because I occasionally pop in on his Funny or Die show, where he's the crazy Tom. I can't remember the name of the show of it, but there is a thing where you think, oh my God, what is he doing to his career, doing this crazy, whacked out character? But then you look at the performance and you go, wow, he's so committed that you actually forget it's him, the actor, and you actually are believing that this crazy character exists and got a show on Funny or Die. It's pretty phenomenal acting piece once you get into it. So. I can't wait to see what he does for Kyle.
Cool. Yeah, it's really fun. It's really refreshing, and it's interesting. It's a really interesting performance, and he's so responsible for the heart and soul of that movie, and it makes me wonder, well, now Fantastic. What are they going to do in the rest of this universe? Because it is in the Godzilla universe, the Monarch Corporation that's in that Bryan Cranston Godzilla. They are front and center, mm-hmm. even though this is a prequel of sorts to that movie. But
right.
that movie didn't work, and that movie didn't work because there was no human through line that you cared about.
Right. And I guess this is the lesson that you're going to have to do for all these product locomotives. Regardless of how big you make your things, your monsters, your DC, your action heroes, there still has to be a human element, a story running through all of these things. And if, you know, and as we know, executives listen to our show. That's the one takeaway we could take from the show today. It would be that lesson right there.
I referenced also seeing Beauty and the Beast, and there is no bigger product locomotive than Beauty and the Beast. You know,
really?
A movie, well, look, a $1 billion movie adaptation of a $1 billion Broadway musical adaptation of a $1 billion animated musical adaptation of a classic French fairy tale, right?
Right.
I wish I was watching the Cocteau Beauty and the Beast, La Belle et la Bête, but you can't have everything, right? So right. instead, you get almost nothing. And look, nobody loves Emma Watson more than me. She is the cleverest witch of her age, Hermione Granger, and bad casting as a result, because we're not allowed to discover her. We're not allowed.
Oh,
you know, she already is. You have a hard time. You know, she's supposed to be outcast, this Belle. Yes, a beautiful girl, but with a mind of her own, an independent thinker, a dreamer, a reader, and therefore an outcast in her own society. It's just too much nail on the head for someone who's played that very role in 8 Harry Potter movies.
All right.
And then when you have to auto-tune that song, the singing voice, and I'm not saying that you had to because she can't sing. All I know is they auto-tuned her, and you hear the auto-tune, and that always
really?
Announces not an authentic musical experience, right? And yet other
right.
singers are not auto-tuned, and they're doing a great job. So whatever reason, they choose to make her sound like everyone else. Well, if she's going to sound like everyone else, then cast somebody else. And
right.
Or... Or how about there is nothing wrong with dubbing the singing? We did our top 10 musicals of all time not that long ago, and at least a couple of them involve famous examples of dubbing, from My Fair Lady, West Side Story,
right?
Singing in the Rain. And there's nothing wrong if that's what makes the movie better, then do that. But at least it's still a human voice.
Yes, exactly. So that you're still connecting to it. Auto-tune, for me, always sounds like, oh, I'm singing in a robot contraption that, is similar to Snapchat, where I put a funny face or exchange faces with my friends. It's just weird at that point and slightly disturbing.
But why? I guess, therefore, it's appropriate because she's acting in a robot contraption. That's what this movie is. It's a robot contraption because everyone says, okay, great, a live action Disney Beauty and the Beast, a live action version of the animated classic. Well, that is what the Broadway musical was. And I was no fan of the Broadway musical Beauty and the Beast, but I thought, okay, they're filming the Broadway musical. Well, no, this is every bit as animated a movie as the original Disney animated movie, except for a couple of characters. Gaston, and Luke Evans is terrific as Gaston, and then Emma Watson and Kevin Kline as the dad, and he's quite charming and touching. But, of course, all the secondary characters are all CGI. They're basically, so I'm still watching an animated movie. The sets are CGI sets. So I'm still watching, as you just called it, a robot contraption. But at least with animation, there is this human artistry involved.
Right.
Right.
Even something hand-drawn.
Yes. Even as the technology advances, there is still human innovation and expression going on in animation.
Right. But with CGI, they're just basically scanning a candelabra and then make it move around.
So there's less humanity than there was in the cartoon. And that's what we want, right? I mean, we want more humanity, not less. And it doesn't matter what kind of movie it is. It doesn't matter whether it's a monster movie or if it's a cartoon or animated film, a musical. We want more humanity, not less. And the reason, because we look around in the world and we see every day seemingly less humanity. So that's why if there is a hope for the humanities, right, as all performing arts are included under, if there's a hope for the humanities, it's that they express humanity and therefore inspire to make the audience more humane. But instead, I love your phrase, a robot contraption. And that really is what that is what Beauty and the Beast felt like to me, was a robot contraption. And longer, by the way, than the animated movie. Yeah, they padded it.
Oh, dear Lord. That's not what I want. That feels a lot of like what movie making's becoming now with all your green screen and your CGI, is that you are just performing in a robot contraption that it goes into computers and filters and a plethora of technologies that, two generations ago, it was unheard of, and so it's taken a while for the artist to adapt the technologies,
I want to talk about some of these independent films that I saw this weekend at the film festival.
Dine here.
But we have one celebrity death to get to, and because it involves a fairly interesting movie and fairly interesting story, I get the feeling, let's talk about it here, and then we'll segue, I bet, into these other movies. But that is the death of Gong Show creator Chuck Barris.
Celebrity deaths.
Right. I was surprised he's still alive, frankly.
Now, I'm going to just ask you, we eulogize in our own unique way these people, but I'm just curious first, Dean. I know Chuck Barris as not only the Gong Show producer and then eventually a host, He wasn't the original host, but he did take over. But of course, he was an aspiring Tin Pan Alley songwriter. He did pen some pop hits like Palisades Park. And he went through the internship programs, I believe, at either CBS or NBC. He was an intern for Dick Clark. And so he's of that ilk. But I'm curious about what, if any, stories you know about him and what, if anything, fascinates you. Because there are, of course, theories about the man.
Right.
Rumors about the man. Conspiracy theories about him. So.
But ones that he perpetuated. That's the thing. Absolutely. In my days in the X-Files, I think around just as the show started, he came out and to say he was a CIA operative the entire time he was doing the Gong Show and had been for some time. Now, of course, because of the X-Files, we, as you know, met I'm saying you and me, but there were CIA employees that had come and talked to us on the show. And I think once or twice I did bring up, when they were talking about CIA's involvement in Hollywood, I go, oh, I guess Chuck Barris would be a part of that. And some would chuckle and say nothing, which would then neither confirm nor deny. And then others, oddly enough, had not even heard this rumor. So I'm not sure where I stand on that theory that Chuck Barris was a CIA operative. At the same time, he knew everybody and he was always in on, talent and stuff. So it wouldn't be unheard of.
Well, this is what, first of all, makes that such an interesting theory and for something for him to say. Because you're already asking, where then is the reality? Right? It's not something that you can wholesale. Where is the real story then? What's the real story? Because not just where is the reality, but where is the real story? What's the real story? I mean, it makes me think of where we're at right now with our current president. Okay, we know this is not factual. So what's the story? What are we supposed to be paying attention to? What are we not supposed to be paying attention to? What is it? What we don't know what the story is the most head-scratching thing. And Chuck Barris was a master of this. And so this, think about this. The first show he sold was The Dating Game. He invented the show The Dating Game. And people might remember this. It was a big hit at the time, right? Singles come on the show and get matched up, and then they go on a date that was chaperoned. Like all of today's reality shows, there was very little reality to that game show because there was there were commercials and profits, actors. And those were real. But the contestants were actors. Steve Martin was on there. Burt Reynolds.
Andy Kaufman.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. John Ritter. Sally Field. Yeah. Farrah Fawcett. Suzanne Somers. So many people, right? John Hamm. Long before Taxi, right? Kaufman, doesn't he appear basically as a version of Latka?
Absolutely. Yeah, and then he gets very upset in his foreign accent when he doesn't win and storms off in a weird comedic thing. And I remember watching that as a kid going, okay, there's no way a real person would do that. That is an actor doing a character. So that was the tip off for me. When I saw that as a kid, I knew that the cat was out of the bag and none of those people then were real.
I think it's very interesting then, this Kaufman and Chuck Barris connection, because there's some real overlap and similarities behind personal mythology, right?
Right.
And so, anyway, that's a big hit. He creates the Gong Show, and again, so many people are not necessarily launched, but a lot of great talent finds an opportunity on there. Again, Steve Martin and Paul Rubens pre-Pee Wee Herman.
Pat Paulson.
It's hard to believe that. I mean, I know that Letterman cites as obviously his role model Johnny Carson and as his major inspiration Ernie Kovacs, as someone he stole a lot of stuff from. But it's hard not to think that Letterman's kind of deconstruction of the television late night talk show didn't in some ways gain inspiration from The Gong Show, with things like stupid pet tricks, for example.
Yeah, that rose from Gene Gene the Dancing Machine and Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara telling dirty jokes. Like all of that elements of a talent show deconstructed into just a nonsensical vaudevillian party, which is exactly, as you said, where Letterman's show took off from there.
And so it was very interesting, the character Chuck Barris creates for himself when he takes over as the host. He's so kind and praising mm-hmm. of every contestant after they get gonged, right? He doesn't belittle right. anyone. He's so nice to everyone.
Right.
And then, you know, the story comes out that he's responsible for so many contract killings as a CIA operative.
Well, because he gets his aggression out that way, I guess. Wouldn't that be the thing? Wouldn't you be, you know, if you had contract killings, you would kind of be, yeah, at peace because all of your negative shadow energy got out in your underworld.
And it's almost like he wanted, although, right, if that were true. And if it is not right. true, then what it is he wanted to create an alternate persona to give expression to all those parts of himself he didn't get to as a television personality.
Right.
You know, so, because people say that he was so deeply insecure and that he hated being seen by the world as such a wimpy milquetoast who had contributed nothing of enduring value. So he created this whole second concoction, but character. But I keep coming back again to Andy Kaufman.
Right, that this is a story, or you create a mythology upon mythology, once over top of itself. I mean, and that was Kaufman's whole thing, right? Even the second persona of Fat Tony, whatever, I can't remember that act, that horrible stand-up, that was also him, right?
Oh, right. So. Right. Who still appears Tony, from time to time. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's somebody else doing him or, you know, keeping that alive that Andy Kaufman never had faked his own death. So, and exactly. And then this comes back to, if all of this is a mythology, where is the story? If it's all fake news, if it's all bedazzlement, you know, I go to now to the conspiracy websites where they're now tripping over themselves to try get to back to identifying what the truth is and going, you know, Trump sold us out. This is the conspiracy. There's no Pizzagate. Alex Jones just apologized for Pizzagate proliferation. So there's this weird mesh going on now, as you said, of what is the narrative? What is the story, if all the story is a mythology, where do you plant your feet?
Well, one of the most interesting things to come out of the Trump Russia investigation is that Paul Manafort had been, you know, his campaign manager had been working for, Russian oligarch for many, many years, high paid job, helping construct a plan to destabilize democracies in the West, including the U.S. And that was their plan because that was helpful to, you know, the Russian government. And therefore, you know, you can't separate out the leaders in Russia politically from these billionaire oligarchs. Right. So that's one of the most interesting things to come out. And where this trail has been leading now is into the alt-right news with Breitbart. And even Alex Jones got mentioned as now having ties that can be proven to the Russians. And
I know
we go back to this, and why I bring it up is just this conversation we used to have when we were making The Truth Is Out There about the conspiracy theory being the conspiracy itself. That
right.
if we can get you to question everything, there's a wonderful, healthy element to questioning everything. The other side of it is if you question everything, then you reject everything. And,
right, that nothing is true.
And then that that does indeed destabilize things. So it's this, you know, and so it's fascinating. And it's interesting that you went there with this because there was a really fascinating Daily Beast article from Jonathan Leaf, a playwright and a journalist, about Chuck Barris. And I just dialed up the conclusion to his article. And I think this you might like this.
Okay.
He wrote, arguably Barris's real legacy. One might argue that the rise of culture of narcissism was inevitable, that as Marshall McLuhan put it, the medium is the message. And that's almost surely right. But just as the telephone would eventually have been developed without Alexander Graham Bell, AT&T was not a predestined creation. Likewise, a show like The Apprentice was certain. The timing of it and its form were not. President Trump, therefore, is part of Chuck Barris's legacy. It will not be his final one, though, for we have only begun the journey. The question is whether this resultant concoction, i.e. our culture, will ultimately prove so toxic that we will all be gonged off the stage.
Wow. That is fascinating. That's right, because once your culture is toxic, there is a idiom to this. There is a philosophical thinker who talks about a toxic culture, a culture industry, I believe was the 1920s term of following the snake eating itself and shooting itself out and eating it again, is that the end result of a culture industry was that you have a society that falls apart because there is no center to it and that it just spins out of control in every direction. So, yes, is this the beginning of the spinning, or is this us shedding a skin to find our center once again? That's the question.
I mentioned that I saw several films at the film festival, and I think there's something about each of these that will appeal to you, at least conversationally, if not as something that you want to check out. The opening night film at North Hollywood Cinefest was a movie called I Had a Bloody Good Time at House Harker. And this is a comedic vampire riff that was made by filmmakers from the Midwest, and it is about how Mina Harker and Jonathan Harker make it back to America after their battles in Transylvania, right? They move to the Midwest, and they bring some problem with them, okay? And but this is generations later, and you see their story on screen, and there's some cool effects, but the acting is so terrible, and you're thinking, oh, dear God. Oh, dear God. And then all of a sudden the fourth wall breaks and you realize what you've been watching is their descendants several generations later putting on a stage play about their forebearers thing. And so you go, oh, that's great. Okay, this has set up something really fun. Like these later generation are trying to live up to their ancestor story. And because that's what they crave to, and there's a wonderful commentary, right, on when you are the descendants of famous people, how many of those families descend into this seeming cottage industry of just sucking the dead bones of their illustrious ancestors dry, right?
Exactly.
Versus this kind of version of obviously it's human nature to want to keep their memory and their legacy alive, but there's something to being able to breathe life back into it, to being able to keep alive the relevancy and the resonance of what your ancestors did versus this kind of desperate need to find your own relevance in what they did. Right? That's a fine line, but it is energetically and emotionally a profound one. So anyway, it really focuses on this next generation of Harkers in present day. The problem is that the acting is kind of every bit as bad as in that. Yeah, and what's sad about it is in this day and age, there are so many really good actors. Some are famous, some are not, some are recognizable, some are not. but who will do any number of independent films if what you're offering is something interesting. So filmmakers out there, don't think you can't get great talent. There is so much great talent and so many great actors who are willing to do something special. But I will say this for the filmmakers of this. This is a movie that actually, how many times have we talked about this? How many films recover from a bad first act? Damn few. How many get better with each act? Even fewer still. And this is a movie by its third act is really clicking. As they set up the showdowns and what they do with it and knocking the climactic scenes on their side to get laughs. And there is some hysterically funny stuff in it, and it gets funnier as it goes along. You know, that's obviously a doff of the cap because that is really challenging to pull off.
Fantastic. That sounds good. Had a bloody good time at House...
Harker.
What was it? House Parker.
House Harker. Oh, okay. Like Mina Harker and Jonathan Harker at House Harker. Yeah.
Right.
It's from Clayton Cogswell is the filmmaker of that. I think it has distribution. I think Shoreline might be distributing that film.
Excellent. Maybe I'll see it.
I saw an interesting documentary that might best have been two documentaries or a series. How often have we heard that before? But from Adrian Esposito, and it's called Diffability Hollywood, D-I-double-F as in Frank, Diffability Hollywood. I'm not pretending to have a lisp or making fun of people with a lisp. And indeed, my fear when I first saw the ad for this and saw Johnny Knoxville in it, I feared this was a make fun of the handicap kind of thing. You know, something Jerry Lewis would have specialized in. But no, it's from Adrian Esposito, who is himself a filmmaker who is autistic. And he had become aware of documentaries that were shining a light on the history, for example, of Native Americans in the film industry and other groups. And he realized there was no documentary looking at the history of disabled in the film industry. So he set about to do that, to fill that need himself. And the result is this documentary, Diffability Hollywood. And the name is because... He chooses to see these people not as disabled, but as differently abled people.
Right. That's the term. They're differently abled.
Exactly. Yeah. So hence diffability. And
I get it.
Look, it couldn't fail to be interesting, right? I mean, here's the interesting thing about this, is that my criticisms of it are coming from someone who is not autistic. And I don't know, therefore, if my criticisms are valid. Because this is probably depicting and telling a story the way someone who is differently abled would tell this story. Right? And so anyway, but here structurally is it. It goes through several chapters of laying out the history. And through laying out the history, we do meet a couple of people who are currently working in the business. But then as the film goes on and gets into its second half, now it becomes a movie that is about biographies of disabled people working in the business. And so it feels like different films altogether. And so by the time we get to the heart of it and out of the academics of it, we've been sitting with it for an hour and a half. And and so it seemed to me that the movie structurally should have been first and foremost about these biographical interviews of disabled people working in the business in a variety of capacities, and in learning about their stories, then weaving in the history. How were they affected by the history? How were they affected by past portrayals or by past groundbreakers, etc.? Now, that said, that's the movie I would make. And I did not enjoy the movie as much as I would have if this movie were not structured more like that. And were I a producer, that's what I would have urged. However, I have no doubt that that reflects a structural point of view that might not be a structural point of view that someone with Adrian's form of autism has in their bag of tools.
Interesting. So it's your perspective of, yes, of what exactly.
And so what makes a better film? So what makes a better film? The story being quote unquote more pleasing, or the story reflecting how Adrian processes information?
Yeah, that's a great question.
And I don't know how to answer it. I really don't know how to answer it. And I don't know.
Did he speak afterwards?
Yes, he did. His Q&A got very much hijacked by some of his cast members, and it can when the person who we would think should be the spokesperson for a film, i.e. the movie's director and producer, is someone who's autistic.
Yeah, exactly.
That creates the opportunity for other people to step forward and take away that role from him, which, by the way, is what happens all too often in real life.
Fascinating.
I also thought this, and I wanted to share this with you, because, you know, I feel very good about, one of the things I feel very good about with our film, The Lady Killers, is the diversity on display. You know, women, people of different ethnic backgrounds, different colors, right? Ages, etc. There's great diversity on display in the mosaic that is the cast of The Lady Killers. Okay, so I feel very good about that. And then I'm watching Diffability, and I am learning in this documentary that fully 20% of the American population identifies as disabled in some way. Physical disability, mental disability, intellectual disability, emotional disability, all of these kinds. And you think, yeah, okay, that actually probably does make sense. So it's upwards of 20%. And of course, historically, far less than 1% of all characters on screen are that are depicted are disabled. And of course, a great percentage of those are played by non-disabled actors.
Right.
Which is a separate issue, separate and not equal issue that we'll discuss in just a minute. But I'm hearing that, and it's breaking my heart that here I am at the world premiere of this documentary, and there are darn few people in attendance that were not involved in the making of the movie. So literally, he's preaching to the choir, and maybe the reason that that's okay is it proves the point of the documentary, which is it is really a struggle to change hearts and minds one person at a time. And maybe I'm that person. Maybe the few other filmmakers who were there are those people. That, of course, this is not a movie, nor should it be a movie, that is drawing huge crowds right away, because it would almost say, okay, this movie, in a way, isn't needed. But the fact that there weren't people there kind of proves how needed the movie is. And I was thinking about this depiction, because it's easy to say, oh my goodness, 20% of the population, but only 1% of the characters on screen are depicted. That is wrong. That is wrong. We've got to fix it. But it's always more interesting to say, well, what's right about that? And what I realized today as I was just driving across town and back, seeing this mass of humanity in my wake, right? How many disabled people did I actually see? Or was I aware that I was seeing? I guess the way in which having less than 1% of all roles on screen depict the differently abled, how that serves is that it actually reflects in a weird, authentic way culture. Yes, the numbers of the differently abled in culture are closer to 20%, but the numbers that we see or are aware of on a daily basis are so small because of the way our culture still to this day pushes them on the fringe, marginalizes, isolates, chooses to ignore the differently abled.
Right.
So it's not so much that I like to think that film is violating or abandoning its responsibility. It actually is reflecting the problem of larger society. And the good news is, as we become aware of it, we can be a part of the solution by hopefully casting differently abled actors in,
right,
in roles that are maybe hopefully not even specifically written for the differently abled.
Well, that's Vince Gilligan in Breaking Bad, isn't it? The son of Walter has a disabled, and that actor could
R.J.
ramp
Mitty.
It up. And,
yes.
And R.J. Mitty. That's an excellent example of, like, that wasn't a main story point. The series did not in any way center around him, and yet how much did he add to the entire series of Breaking
That's
Bad?
That's it. His personal experiences added a deepened humanity to it. I feel very good about what I've been able to do in my own modest way in terms of creating opportunities for actors of diverse backgrounds in various of my films, including The Lady Killers. I am someone who fundamentally believes that our ethnic differences, our racial differences, our gender differences do not make us different per se. What definitely does make us different, though, is how the way we are perceived affects us,
right,
and our behavior and, yeah, our life experiences, right? How we are perceived does affect us. And so bringing those experiences to bear through performance will only inform and root a character in a deeper authenticity and a deeper humanity. And what was the phrase you used? A robotic construct?
Contraption.
Contraption. It will bring,
right,
humanity to even the most robotic of contraptions. So I look forward to, in my future films, allowing for the differently abled to be cast in roles that maybe are written for the differently abled, but equally as much so for people who are not written with that specifically in mind, just where, hey, this actor brings some real unique set of experiences that are allowing them to connect with something that makes this come alive.
Right, right. So, hooray!
Hooray
for that, I say.
The final film that I want to talk about having seen is a movie called Home, and it's from a first-time,
right,
feature filmmaker, Daniel Maldonado. Home is an acronym, and it's about three different characters in two different storylines that are cross-cut, though they never intertwine. You know, they never,
wow,
meet, but they're cross-cut. And it's about three different characters on one night, on a sweltering summer night in New York City, three different characters trying to find home, trying to make their way home. That means something different to each of these characters. One of them is a young autistic man, coincidentally, immediately after seeing the documentary about the differently abled, I see this movie. And the other two characters, one played by a beloved Mexican soap star who plays an Ecuadorian immigrant cab driver. And this guy, I wish I could dial up his name, but my laptop ran out of juice. This guy's the most interesting man in the world. He should be a huge international star. and then there's a woman who's trying to get home to her sick son in Chinatown, played by Angela Lin, who is, of course, so great,
yeah,
in year one of SciFest. She walks away with the best piece in SciFest, the year that that you were involved in. There it's
right. Remember that?
The Ray Bradbury thing. But what I love is, here is this first time filmmaker. He's made other shorts, but when he sets out to make his first feature, what kind of feature does he want to make? I want to make a multi-story line character tone poem. The tone of this movie is so beautiful, so fragile, and he took so much time clearly making this and getting it right. There are background posters at some point in the subways for that Daniel Craig Harrison Ford movie, Cowboys versus Aliens. So you know they filmed it a long time ago,
right?
At least pieces of it.
Yeah.
And yet he really took his time to keep going back and shooting more and going into the editing to really find the form of this. A lot of it is taking a little bit of a guerrilla approach, sometimes a documentary approach. But it's stylish. It's unique. He had made short films that I imagine are really beautiful, artistic, experimental films. And it's a really humane, beautiful film. And this is a first-time feature filmmaker. And that gives me...
That's amazing.
Yeah, so much restored hope.
After a hopeless... afternoon, is that right?
No, I mean, just, after the day after seeing these product locomotives to then,
oh, yeah,
you know, to then turn around and see these films was quite the soothing balm, right? We need both. We need product locomotives and we need tone poems. And so thank God, but there's always going to be people signing up to make the product locomotives. I worry sometimes that we might not have the people signing up to make the tone poems. So
I
we have to seek them out. That's the other thing.
Exactly. Let that voice be heard.
The challenge for me was in watching a movie where, look, this is my advice to you. Don't watch a movie where one of the main characters is autistic right after watching a documentary about how the disabled are portrayed on film, because you will never have more of a critical, judgmental eye towards that non-disabled performer playing a disabled part than you are in that moment. And this young actor who played the part, and again, I wish I had his name, but I don't have my notes, and Akash is upset about the whole thing. But
yes, Akash is very sad.
But he avoids mimicry altogether, which is terrific. He really roots the character in something specific, something authentic. It is a real character come to life. However, the allowance that they no doubt made because of the sweltering August heat wave that was no doubt making it 120 degrees with 100% humidity in those subways, they let him be in a short sleeve, almost muscle shirt that revealed how ripped this guy is. Not that some autistic, and high-functioning autistic people and people with Asperger syndrome can't be bodybuilders, can't be. Of course they can. But it's such a specific physicality this guy has that they would have been better off. Yeah, it would have been tough on the actor. But putting him in like an oversized hoodie so that we could project our own belief of the character's physicality onto it instead of seeing an actor who had clearly just come from the gym.
Right.
You know, because the veins are popping, you can tell that this guy at times has just come from a workout.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, right? This is...
as opposed to someone in this case who has run away from home and who's living in the subways, on the subway trains, right? He's not going to be all jacked at that particular moment. So
that's true. That is true.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's the lesson.
Yeah. Two lessons. Context. Two lessons. Really. Yeah. Really. All movies are in context. So don't watch the documentary right before that pulls the plug on the believability of the movie you're next going to see. But also don't allow for their comfort. Don't allow for their comfort, man. I mean,
You know what? There's an element of truth to that, because, you know, if you're too comfortable, you lose believability, particularly if you're portraying something where you're enduring a hardship or a conflict. I mean, that is the essence of an actor, isn't it?
Well, you know,
you go to uncomfortable places emotionally, physically.
What a great segue to our closing. I mean, we'll talk more about our film, The Lady Killers, in the weeks to come. People can follow theladykillersmovie.com, and they can certainly find it on Facebook and keep track. But we'll share some, you know, anything interesting that comes up about it. But last night we did a big Q&A panel afterwards, and it was very well received. It was so much fun. especially being in a big crowd that is laughing their way through some of the most uncomfortable moments in the movie. Really, what is emerging is that more and more people, I think, are ready to have the conversation that we wish to engage in with this film, namely the functions and the role that misogyny and exploitation have in driving much of our cultural conversation.
Right.
But I did try to address one question beforehand, which was, why even make a movie that is so unsettling that it makes me uncomfortable watching it, let alone right? the audience? And the answer to me comes from Emerson, who wrote that only as far as people are unsettled is there any hope for them.
Ah, see? There's hope for you then.
And there's hope for you as an actor. As long as you are made uncomfortable and unsettled, there is hope for you. But that is kind of what you're getting at, that you have to embrace the discomfort as an actor.
Right.
Right?
Go outside your comfort zone. I mean, we do that in yoga. We do that in all fields, theoretically, if we want to grow.
You know, people will say that this performance or that performance is courageous. And what do they mean by that? Because, look, it's not... Usually filmmaking is not actually dangerous, right? But hopefully what it is a safe place, just like theater, right? It's a safe place to do dangerous internal work, to do risky work, because you are willingly embracing the discomfort, the fear, the powerlessness to find something within you that might move and be meaningful to other people. That's what we mean. And so a lot of times it does mean embrace the discomfort, to sit in that fire. Literally the fire of 120 degree August night in a subway. So
fantastic.
Anyway, everyone knows how they can find this show and how they can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We'll read those handles next week. But next week we're back with a very special show when we count down. I think it's our 8th top 10 show of the year, of year 10.
Yes.
Count down our top 10 all time favorite visual artists.
Oh, that's going to be good.
So until then, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Spoiler alert.